Okay, so what I want to talk about is the issue of putting chiral fermions onto the lattice, and my goal is to look how to do this in a field theory, rather than, you know, I want to keep my feet on the ground and ignore gravity and not wander off into higher dimensions. So I also thought I'd follow the lead of Andreas Frommer and show you some pictures of the effects of the rain around here over the last few weeks. So this, believe it or not, is Death Valley. That's right. So this is work done in collaboration between the LHPC and UKQCD collaborations. So just to start off, I want to remind you how someone who lives in four dimensions wants to think about chiral symmetry. I mean, first of all, we have some convention. Being on a lattice, we work in Euclidean space, so all our gamma matrices are Hermitian. I'll write D for D mu gamma mu, merely because writing D slash in PowerPoint is painful. And I'm going to assume that all the Dirac operators are gamma phi Hermitian. So this property holds. It seems to be true in practice, but. So the idea of lattice chiral symmetry, the way that it should have been discovered, rather, which is totally disconnected from any history, is that one can have chiral symmetry on the lattice without doublers if one only insists that the symmetry has to hold on shell. Okay, this gets around the no-go theorem. So one writes down the Lucia symmetry. One says one has some fermions which transform this way under a chiral transformation. So instead of just having a constant times gamma phi, one has some factor in front which depends on the actual Dirac operator. So this becomes chiral symmetry when you apply it to something for which the Dirac operator gives zero, in other words, on shell. And I should point out that, as always, the field psi bar, or psi dagger, is an independent field from psi in the functional integral. So we can choose it to transform as we wish. So although it transforms as a spinner, so it's got the same spin 4 transformation properties as psi dagger, Euclidean space psi bar and psi dagger are the same thing, it doesn't have the same chiral transformation properties, okay, even in the continuum in Euclidean space. So the fact that the signs come out this way is a choice. That's a reflection of the fact that what we're really going to be considering is vector-like theories which have a chiral symmetry. We're not going to look at the issue of how to actually get vial fermions onto the lattice, which would require insisting that you have some real form, or the analog of a Euclidean analog of a real form here. So in any case, if we want to have this symmetry, then the Dirac operator itself has to be invariant under the symmetry. That's what you mean by saying the symmetry of the theory. So we require this condition has to be true, and as we all know, that you take an infinitesimal transformation for alpha that leads to this relation, which is just the Ginzburg-Wilson relation here. So if we have this on-shell chiral symmetry, in sort of basically the most general way one can write it down, given an arbitrary Dirac operator, which defines what we mean by on-shell, then we have to satisfy the Ginzburg-Wilson relation. And the Ginzburg-Wilson relation has a solution that's got an essentially unique solution, depending on what we mean by unique. And following Herbert, we write the Dirac operator in this form as 1 plus gamma 5 times gamma 5 hat. Then if we want to have gamma 5 hermeticity, then we have to choose gamma 5 hat dagger. So gamma 5 hat is Hermitian, in which case we get gamma 5 hermeticity, and vice versa. And this satisfies the Ginzburg-Wilson relation if we say that gamma 5 hat has to be a square, has to have a square of 1. So that means that we still, of course, insist on one other thing. We must insist this theory actually has a continuum limit which corresponds to a spinner. So we have to have the right continuum limit. So the lattice operator in the continuum limit as a goes to 0 has to go to some multiple of d slash. Or if you like, make that the gauge invariant version of it. And that, we write that way. And then there's a solution which Herbert told us how to write down, which is that you just take this operator here, where I've replaced basically 1 over A times some constant by capital M, which you can either call the negative mass, if you're used to overlap fermions, or you can call it domain wall height, if you're used to domain wall fermions. So you just write this down, which is so gamma 5 hat is uniquely the sine function of the Hermitian version of the whatever lattice operator you have. I put dw just to differentiate it from the five-dimensional operator. You can choose whatever lattice operator you have that has the correct naive continuum limit with a suitable negative shift. And up to the choice of what kernel you put in here, this gives you the unique solution of the Ginzburg-Wilson relation. So, I thought I'd give some references so that people won't complain too much later, and then I'll go on quickly before they've had a chance to read them. whatever it was cited there. So now we get to the issue which we're going to try and address in this talk, which is how do we actually calculate things using the Neuberger operator on the lattice? So here's the operator which we want to simulate with, which for suitably smooth gauge fields is a local operator. Now mu, what I've done is I've put in a physical mass mu, a quark mass, as opposed to the negative mass capital M, or the main wall height, which is still living inside this H up there. So what I've done, this is just a simple rescaling. The quantity gamma 5 hat, you can easily verify, is a unitary operator, so its spectrum lies on a unit circle. And since I'd have half in front, it lies on a circle of radius a half. And this scaling has just shifted it so the maximum stays at 1, but the minimum, instead of being at 0, is shifted by an amount mu in order to give me a physical quark mass of mu. So there's random factor of 2, which you can put in to confuse the issue. So what I want to try and convince you of is that all the methods we know for simulating the Neuberger operator on the lattice basically belong to one class, which is, if you like, a four-dimensional space of algorithms. There are four different directions in which we can vary things, and we can basically produce all combinations in this four-dimensional space. And the dimensions, we can change the kernel. So what I wrote down, you can start off, for example, with the Wilson kernel with a negative mass, like that. So H is just the Euclidean Dirac operator. We can change the approximation we use for the sine function. So all our methods will use some rational approximation, which I'll call epsilon of degree nm, in its argument, which is this Hermitian Dirac operator. And we can choose whatever rational approximation we like. And you can rewrite all the different methods just by choosing different rational approximations. We can change the representation, that is, how we express the rational function in the algorithm. So I'll come to that in more detail. And finally, we can change the way that we impose a constraint. In other words, how do we take this theory and reduce it down to give us an effective four-dimensional theory corresponding to the Neuberger operator? So I'll try and convince you that when we put all these together, we get all the known formulations. We see they're all equivalent to each other. So let's start off by looking at the kernel. So we can start off with the Wilson kernel, which was also called the Barici kernel, because Barici derived this from the domain wall formulation and first showing that that was equivalent to a Neuberger operator. In the domain wall formalism, one gets the Shamir kernel, which looks like this. Of course, it's the same thing in the continuum limit. So you could also just modify this by changing dw to add on whatever irrelevant operators you like. Okay. And recently, Brouwer and collaborators introduced the Möbius kernel, which is this, which interpolates between these two by just choosing different values for these parameters, b5 and c5. So you can sort of get a continuous family of kernels between the two. So that's the first part, what kernel we use. So we can choose various choices for that. The second thing is we can choose what approximation we use for a sine function. Now, the first approximation was introduced by Herbert. Slightly before him, it was introduced by numerical analysts, in particular Higham, and slightly before them was introduced, I think, by some people who are here, or one of whom is in Santa Barbara, so I thought I should mention them. And I'm going to write down the formulas for even n. You can write down analogous formulas for odd n, but it's just too many signs change to make life difficult. So what you do is it's rather like a Chebyshev polynomial. In a Chebyshev polynomial, one takes the cosine n times the cosine inverse of an angle, and it turns out that's a polynomial. If you take the hyperbolic tangent of n times the inverse hyperbolic tangent, you in fact get a rational function, and you can easily enough show that it's of this form. And in this form, you can also then calculate what the roots are. So one can write it in factored form, and the factors just come out to be ordinary tangents. So those are the roots of this rational function under zeros. And you can also, of course, transform it into partial fraction form like this. So there are lots of things you can do to write this rational approximation. And in particular, I want to point out one thing for later reference, that these points at which the rational function becomes 1, okay, where this factor vanishes, I'm going to call the values of x omega j. In this case, the values of omega j is equal to 1. All the whole lot of repeated roots, n of them, which correspond to this omega j. So the significance of that will appear later. So one can do a different approximation, a somewhat better approximation, and this is, in fact, an optimal rational approximation in the sense of the L-infinity norm. And this was, in fact, derived over 100 years ago by Zolotarev, who was apparently a student of Chebyshev's. And it was written explicitly in terms of elliptic functions. So what it says, actually, is that if you view the elliptic function Sn of some scaled argument with some modified parameter, and you look at it as a function of Sn of z and k, then this relationship here always has to be rational in Sn of z and k. That's a basic property of elliptic functions. And what you do is you choose these parameters such that this elliptic function has the same real period as this one, but has an imaginary period which is multiplied by n. So this is just one of the modular transformations for elliptic functions. And this, in fact, becomes a rational approximation for the sine function. One way to see it here is that here's the real part of the complex surface of this elliptic function here. And when you take Sn from minus 1 to 1 and real, you follow this path here. The color is the imaginary part, so you've got to follow places where it stays blue, in other words, where you have a real function. And if you trace out that contour, you get this approximation. So one of the periods of the elliptic function gives you the sine function, the other period gives you these equal height wiggles, and that's exactly Chebyshev's criterion for getting the best L-infinity approximation. Okay, and in this case, these magic numbers omega, which I'm going to come to later, are exactly the points at which this function crosses 1. So these errors oscillate around 1, so these points here are where these cross 1 are the omegas. You can express them explicitly in terms of elliptic functions, elliptic integrals. So, now let's deal with what I like to call the fermion sine problem. How do we approximate the sine function for fermions? So let's consider an approximation, just for example, over a range where x lies between 10 to the minus 2 and 1. And this has to be an approximation of the sine function, so it also has to be valid for minus x between minus 1 and 10 to the minus 10 to the minus 2. And let's compare the Tansch approximation with the elliptic function approximation of the same degree. So consider an approximation of degree 7, 8. It's obvious it has to be an odd function, right? So that's why the degrees of numerator and denominator differ. So here I plot what the error is, that's the difference between our approximation and the actual sine function, as a function of the logarithm of x. Okay, so in this logarithmic plot, you can see that this is the Zolotarev approximation. It has the properties that the error oscillates, and these oscillations get much more rapid as you go towards zero. That's roughly equally spaced on this logarithmic plot. And when you go outside the region of approximation, it suddenly shoots off and becomes really bad at both ends. But the errors here, you can see, are pretty small. Over the range where we want to approximate it, it ranges between about 5 times 10 to the minus 3 and minus 5 times 10 to the minus 3. Whereas if we plot the hyperbolic tangent approximation, which is just this, we get an approximation which very near to 1 is much better, but it breaks down and gives you a much worse approximation when you get towards smaller values of x, or x nearer to 0. But what you can also see is that this hyperbolic tangent approximation is kind of symmetric on this logarithmic plot. So it's actually a good approximation from about 1/3 up to about 3. So we should use this whole range and not just this little bit of it over here. So, but you can see that generally over the whole range, the Zolotarev approximation is much better. and also the height of these wiggles converges exponentially with the degree of the approximation. Okay, so we have these different rational approximations, so what do we do with them? So we can choose to represent these rational functions in various ways. And all of them are basically going to make use of the Schur complement of the matrix. So I better tell you what the Schur complement is. We were told last week in a talk that a good way to solve a problem is to take a matrix, find it a reduction to get its Schur complement, and that gives you a better conditioned problem to solve. So we're going to do the exact opposite. We're going to start off with a matrix and expand it to something whose Schur complement is the matrix you want, and then solve the larger system. So, but if you have a matrix, a block matrix, okay, so A, B, and C, and D are just submatrices, they don't commute, and we can always block diagonalize this matrix by an LDU decomposition, just Gaussian elimination. Actually, you can just do it by inspection. You can see that you can write it this way. If you just put the ones and zeros in, then the rest can be filled in on inspection. And so this is these are triangular matrices with ones on the diagonal, so they're nice, simple things to deal with. And this is a diagonal matrix whose block in the bottom right-hand corner is known as its Schur complement. And so that's what we're going to be concerned with. And one of the things to notice about Schur complements is that, for example, if we want the determinant of this matrix, it's just the determinant of A times the determinant of this matrix. So you get this formula for the determinant of a block matrix. So the first representation which we're going to consider is a continued fraction representation. So consider a matrix in five dimensions. So what we're going to do is we're going to introduce a five-dimensional matrix whose Schur complement is it's a set of blocks, four-dimensional blocks, and we're going to arrange that the Schur complement of this five-dimensional matrix is the Neuberger operator. So one thing, we consider this matrix here, which has got some matrices A on the diagonal and ones and above and below it on the sublevent diagonals. And we compute its LDU decomposition. Again, this is very easy to do. You just get this factor and you can extend it by inspection, where these S's are defined recursively the following way, that S0 is just A0, and Sn for any one of these is just equal, when you add, or it's equal to An minus 1 of Sn minus 1. So that's just what you get from doing the LDU decomposition. And that means that the Schur complement of this matrix, that's the bottom component, Sn, is just, or S3 in this case, it's just A3 over 1 minus S2, which is S2 is A2 and 1 minus S1, and so on. So you see that you just generate a continued fraction representation as the Schur complement. So it's the continued fraction representation where the coefficients are the diagonal elements of the original matrix. So we can use this to... I'm going to try to do this because I want to make all the other methods in a similar framework. So we can use this to linearize our rational approximations to the sine function by writing our rational approximation in this form, and we'll just notice that you can actually put in these extra coefficients cn, which don't change anything because they just multiply and divide by the same factor, but we have this sort of continuous freedom to change the continued fraction without changing the rational approximation which it corresponds to. And so we see that what we get this Neuberger operator, or at least the sine function, which is easily extended to a Neuberger operator, as a Schur complement of this five-dimensional matrix. Okay, for any choice of C's. Okay, so that's one representation. Another representation, which was the following, is you consider a matrix of this form, and you can also do an LDU decomposition of this. And you find that the Schur complement is just this. So we just arrange this to be the partial fraction expansion of what our rational function is. And then we can write this matrix, which gives us, again, the rational function we want of the Schur complement. So it's another five-dimensional formula, which is the same four-dimensional Schur complement. So we can, well, so much fun, we can do another thing like this. We start up with a matrix of this form. Okay, it's got ones on the diagonal except for a C down the bottom right-hand corner for convenience. And A's, it's a cyclic matrix where we put the A's just above the diagonal, zeros below. And the minus signs are just to make life a little easier. They're not very fundamental. So we can, again, compute its LDU composition just by inspection. and you get this rather interesting form where you get the Schur complement is there, so it now becomes a product of the A's. So if we then set, if we take C plus or minus to be this combination of chiral projectors with a mass mu, and we set this constant here equal to C plus, and we set A0, that's the element down here, to be minus T0, and we set the AJs along here to be TJ, then we find that the Schur complement can be written in a form that looks surprisingly like the Neuberger operator, okay, just with a little fiddling around, times this factor 1 plus T. Okay, this matrix 1 minus T, where T is the product from T0, T1, T2, up to Tn in that order. And of course this is well defined because T commutes with itself. So that tells us that the Schur complement in this case is just the Neuberger operator. If we divide this Cayley transform, as I'll call it, with a parameter mu, and we divide it by 1 to get rid of that last factor of 1 plus T. So again, the Schur complement is the operator we want up to some simple factor. Now this particular transformation of the rational functions is what I like to call a Euclidean Cayley transform, or by rational approximation. That's defined this way. You define the Cayley transform is defined to be 1 minus the original rational function over 1 plus the original rational function. This is an interesting transformation because it turns out it's its own inverse. And therefore it's of course easy to compute for any rational function as well. And if we have an odd function, so if epsilon is odd, then it turns out the corresponding property that the T has is that T of minus X is equal to 1 of T of X. It's equal to T inverse. And if we choose that the value of its odd function, if we choose that epsilon of 0 is 0, then it tells us that T of 0 is 1. If we choose the other alternative, which is epsilon of 0 equals infinity, then T of 0 is minus 1. And that means that the TJ is the factor, we can write T as a product of factors of this form, which correspond to the roots being the omega j's, which I was pointing out earlier for the various rational approximations. And because of this symmetry, the poles occur at minus omega j. So this is just another way of writing a rational function. In Minkowski space, or whatever, an ordinary Cayley transform is a map between Hermitian and unitary matrices, which also is almost its own inverse. And so it's interesting that this gives us a transformation between something that looks like a Hamiltonian and something that looks like a transfer matrix formalism. Now, sorry?
You had a string of T's.
Yes. Yes.
I don't see why.
Well, one page before.
One of them to be, you know, saturated down and then everybody else. The omega j was.
Yeah. The set of omega j. So you have one such factor for every omega j, for every time the. Yes. Yeah, yeah. No. 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 Well, I mean, it is actually easy to see from the definition of the Cayley transform. You see, I wrote the Cayley transform here in this form. So you can see that it's going to be the... Well, T is just the product of those. So that with T of X is going to be 0 whenever any one of the factors is 0.
Oh, so
yeah, yeah. Yeah. Okay. So we can produce the Neuberger operator with a general Möbius kernel by writing down this form, which is basically came from a paper of Brouwer, Origenos and Neff. And in order to actually put it into the... Okay, so what we do to deal with this, we just decompose it into a right-handed and a left-handed part. And then if you choose these definitions of D plus and D minus, with the B's satisfying these conditions, it reduces down to the Neuberger operator with the Möbius kernel inside it. Just to give a little bit more detail to make that easier to understand, what you do is you just cyclically shift. You cyclically shift by this operator. So you take the right-handed parts and you shift them around cyclically and leave the left-handed parts alone. So this is a unitary transformation, so it doesn't do any harm. And that reduces the matrix to this form, which, as you can see, has now got the same structure as the original matrix. You just take out a diagonal factor and you've got it in the form of the matrix we wrote down before. So that's how you can show that it's equivalent to the, you've got the Schur complement, which is the Neuberger operator. So we've written down three different ways of representing rational functions, all of which can be written as the Schur complement of some five-dimensional matrix. So what do we do with it? Well, there are at least two different ways that we can deal with this. The first is we can consider a set of five-dimensional system of linear equations. So you take this five-dimensional matrix, you apply it to some solution, some vector here, and you solve the system where the right-hand side has got zeros except for the right-hand side you want, the four-dimensional right-hand side, in the bottom component. It has to be the bottom component if we're going to have an LDU decomposition, otherwise it has to be a UDL decomposition to make it a top component. And so you notice that D5 has this LDU decomposition, so the upper triangular matrix applied to this just shuffles these phi twiddles among themselves, but leaves psi unchanged. And an L acting on this, or an L inverse acting on that, doesn't change anything, because it just shuffles the zeros among themselves. So if you look at the bottom components here, you get that the bottom line of this equation is just the four-dimensional system we want to solve. So if you solve this five-dimensional system, then the bottom component of the solution you get is just the solution of the four-dimensional system with the Neuberger operator. Now that's not a trivial thing to do, merely because the trouble is that we have a rational approximation in the Dirac operator, and there are also some gamma 5s around. The gamma 5 doesn't commute with the Dirac operator. And so we need to find an operator which is the inverse of this combination of two non-commuting operators. And the way we have done that is by going to five dimensions where the whole problem becomes linear, and therefore we know how to compute the inverse. Okay. Now, another way of doing this is we can introduce a set of five-dimensional pseudo-fermion fields, again, which the four-dimensional one we want lives at the end. If you think of the Cayley transform matrix I wrote down, where we first cyclically shifted the right-handed parts, what we were doing is taking, in domain wall language, chiral fermions which live on the two boundaries of the domain wall, and we can put them both onto the same boundary. Okay? So that's why the physical fields just live at one end, which in this case is the bottom of the matrix. And then we just integrate with these pseudo-fermion fields. So we just integrate over all these phis that we've introduced using D5 inverse. And that just gives us the determinant of LDU. And of course, that's equal to the determinant of D, since L and U are unit determinant matrices. And this is just the product of the determinants of the blocks down the diagonal. So in particular, the bottom right-hand component is the determinant we want if we want to put a weight into a functional integral. So we've got to get rid of these other blocks, and we can do that by introducing some pseudo-pseudo-fermions, or Pauli-Villars fields as they seem to be called, which just have a regular sort of bosonic kernel of DJJ, that's the jth block, and that just gives us the inverse determinant. And so you introduce this for all the blocks except for the one in the bottom right-hand corner, and that just cancels this out, leaving the determinant that we want. Okay? And of course, if you don't want the determinant, but you just want the inverse, you can do that by just calculating the propagator by taking in this functional integral. So that's two different ways of using these five-dimensional systems whose Schur's complement is the Neuberger operator in order to actually calculate the inverse or the determinant or whatever quantities you want of the Neuberger operator in four dimensions. So in this case, when you're doing this integral, you've got to make sure that all the eigenvalues here are suitably positive. That's not a problem in the previous method, but so you occasionally have to double the number of flavors to deal with that. It's basically, if you think about it, you can view it as saying that I'm insisting on the linear equations I had before, and I'm imposing it as a Gaussian integral, in rather the same way that I can impose a gauge-fixing constraint in a functional integral when I want to use the Fadeev-Popov trick, and I can introduce that as an extra Gaussian integral. So, you know, if I take some limits of the scale here, these constraints will become more and more peaked around the solution of the equation. Okay, so those are the various formalisms. So how can we tell how much chiral symmetry we have in these various formalisms? Because they've all got all these different ways of writing down this four-dimensional Nürburgring operator. And what I want to find out which one's actually the best, the cheapest for doing calculations with. And so one of the ways we can measure, or probably the way which we should measure how much chiral symmetry we've got, is to look how much the Ginzburg-Wilson relation is violated. So the left-hand side is the Ginzburg-Wilson relation. So this would equal zero if we had an exact solution of the Ginzburg-Wilson relation. So if I put in an approximation for D, the Neuberger operator, of this form where I have an epsilon here instead of a sine function, then I get a non-zero right-hand side, the amount by which the Ginzburg-Wilson relation is violated. And it's rather cute that you plug it in, you find that this operator delta L is exactly one half one minus epsilon squared. Remember, epsilon is an approximation of the sine function, so epsilon squared is an approximation to one. So if this quantity here is small, then we're guaranteed that the violation of chiral symmetry is small. So delta L is a very nice measure of chiral symmetry breaking. And Brown and Al showed that the usual quantity M res, which people are familiar with in domain wall fermions, can actually be written in this effective four-dimensional theory. It's just the potential moment of delta L. It's if G is the pion propagator, it's just this quantity here. So M res is just one moment of delta L. So if delta L is small, then M res is small. But of course, if M res is small, it doesn't actually require that delta L has to be small as well. So let's look at some numerical studies that we've done to see which of these different formalisms works best. So what we did was we did the calculations by calculating inverses on a set of dynamical configurations from the RBRC collaboration, because these seem to be the most physical ones which we could find. So these are 16 cubed by 32 lattices, which would generate that these, of course, four-dimensional gauge configurations. They were generated using domain wall dynamics with a degree of the rational function n, or ls, in the domain wall language of 12, two flavors, and the domain wall height of minus 1.8, and the physical mass of 0.02. And this was using the dBW2 gauge action, that value of beta. And what we did was we matched the pion mass between the different kernels, so between the Wilson and the Möbius kernels, in order to compare the results. And I should make the comment that all the operators which we used were even odd preconditioned in the same way, so we're trying to compare things as fairly as we can. And also, to be fair, we didn't project out any small eigenvectors of the kernel. That would improve things, but we just systematically wanted to see what happened, so we didn't do that projection. In practice, won't be a useful thing to do. So first of all, let's check that we get the same answer in these different forms, that it's really true. So what I'm plotting here is the pion propagator, and this is comparing the main wall fermion Möbius kernel, that is with B5 equals 1, C5 equals 0, so that corresponds to the Shamir kernel. So this corresponds to the usual domain wall kernel. And I use and I'm comparing that one with the continued fraction approximation, also using the same kernel. And you can see that you get, as far as you can see, the propagators look exactly the same. If you look in a bit more detail at deviation, you can see that it's very small. So within sort of numerical errors you would expect. So you really are calculating the same thing in these different formulations. Likewise here, we compare Borichio, the Wilson kernel, that's this particular version of Möbius, with the continued fraction formulation. So this is doing a domain wall calculation. This one is doing a constraint of the first sort. They're using the same rational approximation, the Tansch in both cases, but using different ways of formulating the five-dimensional matrix. And you can see here also we get the same result. So all these, as they must, all these formulations give the same answer. And in particular, the domain wall is just one way of representing this matrix. It's just using a Cayley transform and representing the constraint as a set of Gaussian integrals. We're just comparing the algorithm for doing the inverses, and they're supposed to be identical. So I'm not claiming whether the 15 configurations are in equilibrium doesn't matter too much. I mean, it's just want something which is going to give us a spectrum for the Dirac operator which looks sort of realistic, we hope. Sorry. Yes. 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 So the fact that this isn't zero, but this is just very small, right? So if I now compare the cases where I use a different kernel, I'm going to compare using the Shamir kernel and the Wilson kernel. You can see that in this case I've got to adjust the parameters in the kernel in order to get the same prion mass. So having done that, I get these prion propagators. And you can see that it doesn't matter whether if I'm using a Wilson or Borici kernel here, it doesn't matter whether I'm using continued fraction or Möbius, continued fraction representation or domain Wolf, they give the same answer. If I take the Shamir kernel, then I get a slightly different answer. That's not surprising. There's a different normalization for the source. But the masses I get, you know, this is the effective mass, basically agree, and they agree to within the amount we bothered to tune the parameters to make the masses equal. So it doesn't matter which kernel you use, you basically get the same answer again. And if you want to compute MRes, you can calculate it for different four-dimensional time slices. And you choose some plateau here, you see again you get the same MRes, whether you're using continued fraction with constraints or whether you're using domain wall fermions. Okay, it's just calculating the same thing, just verifying that that's really true. So now we can look at things which are a little more interesting, and we can ask, well, what MRes do we get on our 15 configurations? So I plotted along here the configuration number, and these points correspond to the various different ways of computing the inverse and then measuring the residual mass that you get. So, for example, if we use this Tansch approximation, then we get this set of residual masses. Notice it doesn't matter which way I compute it, it just depends on the approximation. Okay, the representation doesn't affect the answer. If I, on the other hand, take the Solitaire approximation, which we expect to be a much better approximation, then you see I get a much smaller MRes most of the time. Okay, so I should have much better chiral symmetry. And if I take this one point here, I can also put the Volotarov approximation into the domain wall, as was first written down by Chu. You find that, of course, you get the same answer as putting Volotarov in any other way. Now, I'll come to the cost shortly. So this is just showing what the residual mass is in the two cases. So just out of interest, I also plotted the ratio of the smallest to largest eigenvalue here. Now, when I use the Zolotaryov approximation, I have to put in an epsilon, which is the range over which the approximation is valid, and that's shown by this line here. So you can see that I was ignoring a few small eigenvalues that drop below this line, so that would mess up MRes. What's strange is that sometimes, like in this case, I have a really small eigenvalue, which I'm ignoring, and so getting the approximation wrong, but it doesn't seem to make very much difference to MRes. So either the eigenvalue, it doesn't affect the chirality, or at least it doesn't affect MRes. On the other hand, here's an example where I have a not quite so small eigenvalue, but it does mean that the MRes for the Solitaire approximation suddenly becomes much bigger. So some eigenvalues are important, and some eigenvalues, small eigenvalues aren't important. The idea is, of course, what you would do is you'd actually project out these few small ones, and therefore getting a much better approximation. So basically with Zolotaryov, you can make the approximation arbitrarily good at a relatively low cost. What about the larger eigenvalue? Oh yeah, we fixed it so the maximum eigenvalue is always covered by the range of approximation. Yeah. Well, the largest one's easy to bound. Yeah. One can also play games, one can dynamically adjust the range of approximation as one goes along. There are lots of variants one can do there. The maximum error?
Yeah.
Well, that depends on the degree of the approximation. So it was. Well, this is using the same NS, so I think this is.
Uh,
Yeah, but the peaks are very much smaller. I mean, these are tiny bumps. So we're talking about bumps which are the order of 10 to the minus 5 or something. So even if you set all the eigenvalues on the extreme error of the curve, it's still got a very small violation of delta L. In fact, it guarantees you that delta L is small, not just that then res is small. Yeah. For these eigenvalues, yes. So for these ones that you can expect, that's right. So, but the idea would be in practice that you would project these out or dynamically adjust the Zolotaryov approximation to cover that spectrum. So there are lots of ways you can deal with that. That's also possible. Well, whether they cancel or not, they're still going to guarantee to be very small.
Yeah. That might cover up.
Yeah.
Lucky to have a lot of fluctuations in the other side.
Yeah. But I mean, I think the key point to remember is that we can make the amplitude of those errors so small that I don't really care whether where the eigenvalues lie in it. I mean, I'm absolutely. Yeah. No? Well, but I mean, in this case, what? Well, I'm also, but it could also be that you have a small eigenvalue that doesn't violate chirality. So, I mean, there are various possibilities. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. 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 Well, yes, but that matrix element might be very small in that case, or it might not be. But the point is that remember, at the low end of the spectrum, you basically have a small number of really isolated small eigenvalues corresponding to defects. So the idea of the practice, what you would do is you would project them out. Okay. Yeah. So you. Yeah. Yes. Sure. So in practice, one would want to do projection. Yeah. Quite. Yeah. No, it's a moment of it. Yeah. So it could be that if you weight it with a rho instead of with the pi, it could be worse. I want to stress is that if I take a Zolotaryov approximation, then the error due to all the modes which are above this line, and this line can be moved wherever I want to, the error above this line is bounded by the height of those bumps, which I can make as small as I like, and the small eigenvalues I would tend just to project out in practice. Okay, so I will adjust epsilon so that the number of small eigenvalues projected out gives me the cheapest overall cost. In principle, yeah. In principle, I also ought to do it on a set of configurations that are.
Yeah. Put a source and a thing somewhere,
not
translating a variant here, happen to get from a defect, and happen to make one configuration, one measurement look like this.
Yeah.
The real answer to them red, you can have
it. Yeah. Yeah.
It can happen to be doing the lab. That would be what we're going to be covering on.
Okay. So now I want to come up through the answer to Julius's question, which is what's the cost of all this? Because of course you actually have to do these five-dimensional inverses, and they've got different condition numbers. So you're basically all these methods are inverting five-dimensional matrices, but they're not all equally well conditioned. So we start off over here. This point down here is where we effectively have the ordinary domain wall that was being used by Columbia. And so what you find is you have an MRes which is about 1/10 of the quark mass. And as I increase NS or LS so as to decrease the MRes, you can see that the first one, that's the main wall, it's got a Shamir kernel, it's got a Tansch approximation, and it's represented as a Cayley transform, that the cost increases rapidly. The error bars are basically just a reflection that we only have a small number of configurations and things are fluctuating over them. What's interesting is that if you take the domain, the continued fraction constraint version using Zolotaryov coefficients, you get these blue triangles, which, bearing in mind this is a logarithmic scale, you see we've reduced MRes by increasing the cost by, say, here by a factor of, I mean, like 40%. You've reduced MRes by a factor of somewhere between 10 and 100. And these points, if you did projection, I'm pretty sure would really move down here. So I suspect that you really can make MRes essentially as near zero as you want to without paying an enormous cost. And it's got nothing to do with tuning the kernel. It's just got to do with what approximation to the sine function you're using. Strangely enough, if you take the continued fraction and you put in the Hyam, this Tansch approximation, instead of Zolotaryov, then it turns out to be rather expensive. That probably just means we didn't tune the C's in the continued fraction very well in that case. But the other interesting point, if you take the domain wall, you can put the Zolotaryov coefficients in. Okay, take the Cayley transform, put in the Zolotaryov approximation, use the second of the constraints, then you get the formulation which was written down by Tingwei Chu, and that one has got an MRes, which is the same as all the other Zolotaryov ones, but the cost is off the top of the graph. So it's much more expensive. But it seems to be that that expense is not due to the fact we've got a Zolotaryov approximation. It's got something to do with the different condition number of the five-dimensional matrices we're using. And the other interesting curvature, the most recent one, is you can take a formulation of the continued fraction where we change the kernel to be the Shamir kernel and do a few tricks just in order to go avoid having to actually do an explicit inverse. And we write that in the second constraint, the domain wall-like approach. And as you can see, you get an MRes which is basically the same, because you're still using Zolotaryov, so it's the same as the ones down here. The points are probably over to the left, merely because you've got less configurations. So that's probably just that you haven't seen the ones with the bad eigenvalues. But you can see that for an increase in cost, which is a bit more, so it's a factor of 6 or something over here, or for these points here, maybe a factor of 5 in a bit, you can put the Zolotaryov with the Shamir kernel and also get much better MRes. But why you should want to use a Shamir kernel, I don't know. I mean, it seems cheaper to use the Borici kernel, the ordinary Wilson operator. Yes. No, the blue lines are big errors, which is almost certainly due to the fact that our Zolotaryov approximation is not covering the whole spectrum and that we're not projecting out the small eigenvalues. So if we project out the small eigenvalues, I would expect that all these curves move down towards the left-hand end of their interval. So I think that these blue lines with projection are actually really down here. Yeah. Well, that's right, but they are statistically significantly apart from each other. There are a couple of sigmas out on this. And remember, this blue has just got you know, if you take out the configurations where you could do projection, it will really move down there. So I think there is a very significant difference between those, which is what you would expect, because the Zoltov approximation is a much better approximation than the hyperbolic tangent. I mean, what's harder to predict, so working out what the MRes should be is easy. Working out what the cost should be is more obscure, because that somehow depends on the condition number of the five-dimensional system you've written down. Okay. So, come to my conclusions. First of all, as far as calculating inverses of the Neuberger operator are concerned, it's four-dimensional inverses, the best method we found so far seems to be to using the Zolotarev approximation in a continued fraction representation, and where we can also just solve it instead of exact constraint equations. Also, if you take the if you want to take the domain wall type approximation with hyperbolic tangent approximation, you can improve it by changing the kernel to shift it to make use of the fact that the hyperbolic tangent approximation is actually good considerably above one as well. So that also seems to be relatively cheap, but not as cheap as the, I mean, not doesn't give you nearly as good MRes and as chirality as the first. The standard Shamir version of domain wall fermions doesn't seem to be very competitive in this, and if you put Zolotarev into the domain wall fermions, then for some reason that seems to be particularly expensive. So it doesn't seem to be very good either. But that's just a question of different five-dimensional matrix with a different condition number. So what have we still got to do? Well, as I said, we've got to work on projection of small eigenvalues, which is what one would do in practice, and we've got to work out how we actually put all these formulations to do a hybrid Monte Carlo for dynamical fermions. Now, there are basically two choices. You can either do a hybrid Monte Carlo in five dimensions, so you take the second way of writing the constraints, where you introduce these five-dimensional pseudo-fermion fields and you treat them as dynamical fields, and you evolve the whole system as a five-dimensional system, sort of canonical domain wall point of view. Or you can just say this fifth dimension is just a trick for inverting the Neuberger operator. I can do all my dynamics in four dimensions, and I just use the fifth dimension as a way of computing the inverse of the Dirac operator. So my suspicion is that the latter, the four-dimensional formulation, should in principle be somewhat better, because you have less, because if you impose the constraints exactly rather than putting them in through pseudo-fermion fields, you have less noise in the system, and that should allow you to get away with a larger step size for the Markov process, for the leapfrog integrator. Also, another thing which one might want to do is one might want to reduce that amount of noise even more by introducing multiple pseudo-fermion fields in four dimensions. So it's all a bit confusing. You can get away with a bigger step size by having more pseudo-fermion fields as long as you put a kernel into them, which has got the condition number of each one is improved by a suitable factor, whereas just introducing more pseudo-fermion fields with basically the same kernel just makes it worse. So we can put in more four-dimensional pseudo-fermions with this nth root kernel, which effectively implements Hasenbusch's trick, and that might well accelerate the dynamics. The thing that's lacking for that is we don't know how to do the analog of a multi-shift solver in five dimensions. I mean, we can do a multi-shift solver in five dimensions, but we can't do it when we just want to shift the four-dimensional matrix which we're inverting. It doesn't correspond just to a shift of the five-dimensional system. So this might be a case where using the nested four-dimensional inversions, as described by Frommer last week, might have an advantage, because then you can do a multi-shift solver on the outer CG as well. And one other thing to study is, you know, when one's running a dynamical HMC, is how rapidly do you tunnel between different topological sectors. My first observation, of course, is this is not a problem which is not really algorithmic in nature, because this tunneling rate has to go to zero as the quark mass goes to zero anyhow, so it's going to be hard to get around. The best suggestion of reflection, refraction, if you like, when the system tries to go through the origin of the sine function in some terms. And just as a suitably crazy idea to go, and then things if one wants to just reflect off this, one way you could do it is to take, for example, an approximation which is infinite at the origin instead of one which is zero at the origin, and that would sort of push things away from crossing the origin if that's what you want to do. Okay.
One thing to do the simulation, some physical signal.
if I was doing a hybrid Monte Carlo and I was using a Neuberger operator approximated with say, the Zolotaryov approximation, so it had a very small error on the approximation of the sine function, then I know that delta L has to be small.
So maybe you're using the same probe and physical operator. It's a question of...
That's right, but I mean... But in the case of using Zolotaryov, one has an absolute bound on how big delta L can be. So uniformly over the whole spectrum, you can bound the error. Yes. I think the question isn't about the probe. It's more that you would have an eigenvalue spectrum for the kernel, for the Wilson operator or whatever, which would be unrealistic. So that would be the difference. But whatever the eigenvalue spectrum is, if I project out the lightest ones and take the rest of the spectrum and approximate it with an error which is very small, then I'm guaranteed I will have chiral symmetry violation kept at a very small level. So I can guarantee that for what appears to be a moderate cost, I can really make the mRes as small as I like, and it hasn't got to do particularly with the kernel. I mean, the kernel affects the spectrum a little bit, but it's mainly just using a good approximation for the sine function. Mm-hmm. Well, it's the chiral symmetry of the operator which one's measuring rather than the chiral symmetry.
Yeah.
Yes. But I mean, if I do the dynamics with a good chirally symmetric operator, then I will be simulating the chiral theory. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the point which, the message I want to make clear is that if you want to make MRes small, it's much more effective to choose a better approximation of the sine function than it is to tinker with the kernel of the Neuberger operator, which affects MRes a little bit, but much less than just choosing a good approximation to the sine. The operator is exactly the same operator as before. I'm not throwing out the small eigenvalues. I'm just, if I project them out, I can explicitly.
It's a perfect job when a person gets a two-operator recap.
Yeah.
If you give an eigenvalue, it's a small one. Then you have all the respect.
Yeah.
And that's what seems to be the operator.
Well, you're saying if I don't calculate the eigenvector corresponding to that eigenvalue accurately enough. But I mean, the locality. I mean, if the sine function itself is local, then my approximation will essentially be local. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the other point, which for people who like to think of the five dimensions as being physical, I should point out the strange fact that if you take either the partial fraction expansion or the continued the Cayley transform approximation. So in both cases, you just have a set of roots. You can permute these roots. In the case of a hyperbolic tangent, it doesn't make any difference because they're all one, but in the case of Zolotaryov or other rational approximations, they're different. You can permute these slices. So if you think of it just as a way of having different lattice spacing in the fifth dimension, it actually doesn't matter which lattice spacings are big and which ones are small. You can shuffle them around and you get the identical answer. So this fifth dimension physics is a little bit bizarre in an intuitive way. Well, of course, yes. Well, how physically you view the fifth dimension is a matter of taste. It's not a matter which has an answer. But, and of course, if you have an actual current, for any five-dimensional operator, there is an effective four-dimensional operator. It might be a mess, but.